loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk about the breaking news today. The Supreme Court ruled in the Janus case against public sector unions. We're going to be talking to two labor leaders about what this means for the labor movement. What will it mean in the coming weeks and months and years? We have definitely reached a turning point. Also, Justice Kennedy, one of the nine Supreme Court justices, has announced today his retirement. That gives Donald Trump the opportunity to pick another Supreme Court justice. And then our regular Wednesday segment, Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, where we focus on nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. Today includes discussions of the safest way to hold nuclear waste, which under corporate-led schemes puts nearby residents and residents all along the nuclear waste transport lines under very, very great risk.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, a 28-year-old political newcomer, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, defeated 10-term Congressman Joe Crowley in a Democratic primary in New York yesterday. Crowley is the fourth-ranking member of the House Democratic leadership and was expected to someday become Speaker of the House. He had run unopposed in his last seven races. And despite spending more than $1.2 million compared to Ocasio-Cortez's $128,000, he could garner only 42%. Next, the Trump administration has reversed its policy on family separations at the border for any family that is willing to be deported immediately. This was after a federal judge in California ruled that the policy was illegal and that the Department of Homeland Security had 30 days to return all separated children to their parents. Then FBI agent Peter Strzok testified behind closed doors today before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. Strzok was expected to hear some very pointed questions about 375 text messages that he exchanged with Justice Department lawyer and girlfriend Lisa Page during the 2016 presidential campaign while he was investigating Hillary Clinton's email server. And then Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt is trying to limit one of his agency's most powerful tools to manage or block miners and developers by removing the effective veto power the EPA has over permits to dump waste into waterways. And finally, the Trump administration appears to be making increasingly common the use of sanctions or the threat of sanctions in its foreign and trade policy. The U.S. will place sanctions on Turkey, a NATO ally, when it takes delivery of a Russian missile defense system soon. Washington is asking allies to phase out the purchases of all Iranian oil by November, and trade sanctions on China are ratcheting up. And in other headlines, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is 81 years old, announced today that he is retiring from the Supreme Court. Kennedy is considered to be one of the court's moderates. Donald Trump has already nominated one Supreme Court Justice, Neil Gorsuch, and is expected to nominate another ideological conservative. Michael Rossfeld, an officer with the East Pittsburgh Police, was charged today with criminal homicide in the case of the killing of Antoine Rose Jr., an unarmed black 17-year-old who was shot in the back, the face, and the arm. The charges were brought by Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Zapala, who has been under mounting pressure from activists to press charges. Protests have been taking place in and around Pittsburgh on a near daily basis since Rose was killed on June 19th. A UN special envoy arrived today in Yemen to discuss with officials there a political solution to the intense fighting going on in the important port city of Hodeidah. Saudi and Emirati forces launched an offensive on the port on June 12th, and it has continued since then. Millions of Yemenis depend on the port for food and basic necessities. A summit between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin has been confirmed, while National Security Advisor John Bolton was in Moscow on a diplomatic visit. It will likely be somewhere in Europe while Trump is there in mid-July, although specifics are forthcoming. Alex Fields Jr., the alt-right fascist accused of driving a car into a crowd of anti-racist counter-protesters during last year's Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, has been charged with 30 crimes today, including hate crimes. The car he allegedly drove into the crowd injured dozens and killed 32-year-old protester Heather Heyer. Organizers of the deadly rally are planning to hold another demonstration in Washington, D.C. in August to mark the one-year anniversary. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
loud and clear.
Now we turn to the Supreme Court ruling this morning. It issued a landmark decision in the case of Janus versus AFSCME, ruling 5-4, that labor unions may not collect, quote, agency or fair share fees from workers who do not want to join the union in a union shop, but who benefit from the collective bargaining agreement. The court had ruled 41 years ago that unions could charge only for services that non-union members benefited from, such as negotiating collective bargaining and grievance procedures. The ruling is seen as a major blow to organized labor. We're joined from Massachusetts by Peter Knowlton. He is the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. And we're joined from Los Angeles by Jeff Bigelow. He's an official with AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And earlier, Jeff was in Springfield, Illinois, so knows directly about the Janus case. Welcome, Peter and Jeff.
Thank you.
Peter Knowlton, let's start with you. This is not a huge surprise, but it is a huge setback for organized labor and for working people in the United States. Just what's your initial take?
So I think our initial take on this is, it is, as you said, it's a massive decision against the rights of union workers in the United States in the public sector. And we do see it as part of the wholesale assault on labor unions and on workers' rights that's been going on, well, as long as I've been around in the labor movement. So it's been at least for the last 4 or 5 decades. And obviously it's preceded that as well. But it's just a continual assault on the rights of workers to be able to determine their own destiny and how it is that they want to be able to fund their organizations. I think one of the things that gets lost that for us is a fundamental precept of the collective bargaining agreements and of what is called agency fees or even union dues is that they are all part of collective bargaining agreements that are voted on by a majority of the workers that vote. So to a large degree, a collective bargaining agreement is simply a written expression of what the majority of workers in a particular workplace want. And for the U.S. Supreme Court to now say, oh, well, you can have this or this, but you can't do that, for us is inherently an infringement on our democratic rights as workers to be able to govern our workplaces.
Jeff Bigelow, a quick just technical or legal question. Again, you both of you know, and we don't really know in detail about this, but if there's does this have the capacity to overturn existing collective bargaining contracts that recognize a place as a closed shop?
Yes, it will. It won't overturn the entire contracts, but it'll certainly overturn those portions of the contract that provide for fair share provisions. It may overturn portions of contracts that have to do with what's called maintenance of membership, that have to do with the stability of the union and stability of the membership. So it will do that. And it's and these are provisions, as the union leaders said, that were not only voted on when the contracts were approved, but in the case of fair share, or what's also called agency fee, that's directly attacked by this decision, the ability to have agency fee, the ability to have fair share, is often voted on separately in order to get that. So it's an overturning of what the votes that have already been taken, the majority that has already spoken on this. Is definitely a right-wing billionaire initiative to push back labor.
Peter Knowlton, I was curious as to what unions can do now to maintain the strength that they already have in what have traditionally been union states. This decision, I think, is going to affect mostly states that have long been supportive of unions, Rust Belt states, New England states. What can unions do to at least try to maintain some of the strength and authority that they have in those places?
So for our own union, and we are very much of a bottom-up driven union where our locals are the primary source of our strength and our wisdom. And so for us, it is for the membership and the leadership in different locals to develop very deep relations with its members and the people that it represents. And that now you're going to be on a landscape to a large degree where dues are considered quote-unquote voluntary. So the union is really going to have to show its mettle to the members that it represents and be able to be very responsive to their particular needs. We represent a lot of public sector workers already, as does the brother from AFSCME, in right-to-work states already, right? So we know intuitively what it is that it takes in order to build a strong union when you're working in that particular environment. And it basically, it involves making sure that the members are completely aware, they're informed, that they're actively engaged in every aspect of the union and that they run every aspect of the union. And you've got to give people a reason to want to be able to put money into an organization that actively represents them. So if you are actively engaged, for instance, in concessionary bargaining or two tiers, or appear to be just simply going along to get along with the employer, it's very possible that you might lose membership over that. So you're going to need to really develop some very strong educational programs, some strong fight-back programs, to really be a very, very strong advocate for the members that you represent in that particular workplace. This is a really bad decision, but in some respects, it's going to force the public sector unions to operate a little bit differently, knowing that their ability to collect whatever income they get from dues dollars is not guaranteed from one year to the next.
Interesting. That's the voice of Peter Knowlton. We're talking to Peter from Massachusetts. He's the president of the United Electrical Workers. We're also speaking with Jeff Bigelow, who works for AFSCME. I want to come back to that theme, Jeff, about what it will mean for the labor movement. Could it possibly be one of those situations where the unintended consequences of this vicious anti-labor decision by the Supreme Court will, in fact, push the unions to take a more aggressive, more militant, more fight-back sort of orientation on the ground? Let's come back to that, but just help the audience explain who Janus is and what the genesis is of this case.
Okay. Mark Janus is a child support worker in Springfield, Illinois, who is part of a union, AFSCME Council 31. His logo is AFSCME Local 2600. And he's a state worker because that function is a state function in Illinois. And over the years, the state of Illinois, both under Democratic and Republican administrations, has tried to made moves to privatize, to have massive layoffs, to undercut rights, to not pay people properly, to try to do away with pensions, to try to increase health costs. And the only thing that stood in the way of that has been a very strong AFSCME union there, a very strong activist AFSCME union that organized tens of thousands of workers into action, that has mobilized those members to force Democratic administrations to do things that they wouldn't do in bargaining in terms of getting wage increases, etc. So Mark Janus is essentially a tool of the right wing. The case was not even originally Mark Janus versus AFSCME Council 31. It was originally billionaire Governor Rauner versus AFSCME Council 31. And Governor Rauner made his whole campaign to become governor based on an attack against AFSCME, saying the public sector unions were too strong, AFSCME was too strong, and he was going to force AFSCME into a weaker position, take them out on a strike, and debilitate the union. And when he got into office, he tried to put that into practice by initiating this lawsuit. But he found out that he didn't have standing to do that. The courts ruled that he didn't have standing. They, instead of just throwing out the case, they immediately substituted Mark Janus for Governor Rauner. So he's just a figurehead for the billionaire interests that want to weaken the union. And again, Mark Janus's job in particular would have been privatized out to Maximus if Governor Rauner's positions at the bargaining table had been successful. That they would have privatized it out to Maximus. He's gotten $17,000 in negotiated wages through AFSCME during the time he's been there. His health care costs have not doubled as the governor wants to double his health care costs. So he's been the direct beneficiary of the union. And not only has he been the direct beneficiary, but the union itself has struggled and fought and pushed back and successfully in making sure that the full range of that program that he administers for the people there in terms of child support is not diminished, which is what one of the things they wanted to do. This case comes from that that origin, the billionaire governor trying to smash unions in Illinois, and it's sort of symbolizes what else is going around, not only in the other brother mentioned the Rust Belt. Well, the Rust Belt is not what it used to be in terms of being union friendly. Look at Michigan. Look at
Wisconsin.
All the right to work states. Yeah,
yep.
Wisconsin Act 10 and right to work. So this is a national problem, a national attack that's symbolized by this case. It's symbolized by all the things that Trump is doing right now. Symbolized by all the other court decisions that the court has just issued in the last couple of weeks. So it's a broad attack. But it's not the death knell. In fact, for many, many decades, public employees didn't have the right to organize a union. Public employees didn't have the right to strike, but yet they struck and they won unions and they won rights and they pushed back and lifted the entire working class on their shoulders, even when it was not legal to do so. So this decision is a harmful decision. It's definitely something that's going to have an impact, but it's not the death knell. And it has already, as Brother Norton was pointing out, shaken up a number of unions so that they are now much more, all unions in the public sector are much, much more focused on engaging with the membership and making sure that there's a union consciousness among the membership, that union membership is involved and mobilized. That is absolutely the case. And ask me, I can speak with direct experience about that, about one-on-one conversations with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, actually, and making sure that we're ready for this decision, as ready as we can be.
Peter Knowlton, in her dissent today, Justice Kagan said something that was very interesting. I wanted to get your comment on. She said, public employee unions will lose a secure source of financial support. State and local governments that thought fair share provisions furthered their interests will need to find new ways of managing their workforces. Across the country, the relationships of public employees and employers will alter in both predictable and wholly unexpected ways. What ways might those be? What should we expect to see in relations between public employees and the governments they work for?
Well, it's very possible. I mean, I will remind everybody that after the busting of the air traffic controllers by Reagan in 1980-81, and that struggle, that there became a wholesale assault on workers and on the trade union movement by not only his administration, but subsequent administrations, and created a whole industry called the union bust industry, where professional consultants and lawyers make gazillions of dollars off of the backs of working people over the last 30, almost 40 years. So there's that, but there's also, I know that when Wisconsin was passed, Act 10 was passed in Wisconsin, relations that have been relatively stable and very fruitful between employers and the unions in Wisconsin changed drastically after that decision. And that's in discussions I've had with people who service and who represent workers in Wisconsin, that employers took a very nasty position and had a very nasty edge to their relations with the unions after that law was passed. So I suspect some of that with this, that the relations between the public sector employers and public sector unions will take on a little bit sharper edge, a little bit of a nastier edge. We haven't seen it yet, but today is just the first day of the decision. But I suspect that this does sort of give some oats to employers who think that now they can basically do whatever they want to, that the strength of unions has weakened, which it hasn't. It's just merely the funding mechanism has made it a little more difficult for us. But our strength has no less waned, either pre-Janus or post-Janus, organizationally or politically. And unions are pretty savvy. We're all survivors. We'll figure this out. And as I said before, in some ways, it may make overall the trade union movement a little bit stronger, a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more militant, which would actually be a very positive thing for workers in the United States.
That's Peter Knowlton, president of United Electrical Workers. We're also on with Jeff Bigelow, who was in Springfield where the Janus case came about, representing workers in AFSCME. Jeff is now in Southern California. I want to go back to Kagan's dissent, Jeff, as well. She writes, today the court succeeds in its six-year campaign to reverse Abood. Its decision will have large-scale consequences. And then John read the rest of the sort of quote from her. But she also goes on and says, rarely, if ever, has this court overruled a decision, let alone one of this import, with so little regard for the usual principles of what amounts to, in Latin, a precedent, the court's own earlier decisions, in this case, the Abood decision in 1977. There are no special justifications for reversing Abood. It has proved workable. What we're seeing, Jeff, and we can see this, I think, now with the Trump administration, its character has become revealed. It is perhaps the hardest right administration ever. Even if it does something good, like I would say signing a peace treaty possibly with North Korea, which would be good and a welcome thing. When you look at their position towards unions, their position towards immigration, their position towards women's rights, LGBTQ rights, and especially with Gorsuch now on the Supreme Court, they're going for everything the right-wing billionaires have dreamed about. And now we just heard earlier this afternoon that Justice Kennedy, who is a little bit of a swing vote, mainly a right-wing vote in the Supreme Court, is retiring, which means Donald Trump gets to replace Kennedy with another version of Gorsuch. This is a regime of real class war by the employers and by the ultra rich. I mean, do you see it that way?
Yes, absolutely. And that sort of follows what Brother Nolan was just talking about, the analogy to 1981 and Reagan's destruction of PATCO and the use of the military to essentially accomplish that end. And that opened up a decade, or more than a decade, but definitely the most intensive war was in that next decade, two decades, with massive wage cuts, contracts being ended, contracting out happening, other things like that, all throughout the Midwest and reverberating across the country. And that was, there was very, very difficult times. This is this decision occurs in a different context where the labor movement is even weaker, where only 6.5% of the private sector is organized. The strongest part of the labor movement, the public sector, is affected directly by this, and 33%, 35% of the public sector is organized. So they're aiming this dagger at the financial heart of the strongest part of the labor movement in order to weaken it. And they're weakening it so that they can open up the floodgates to all those entities, all those the interests and powers that want to just ride roughshod and have their program not have meet any resistance whatsoever. In particular, one of the things that they will be focusing on in the near future, almost certainly, is pensions. They said in California, they said explicitly that they were pulling back on their last initiative to end public sector pensions, defined benefit pensions, a couple of years ago, because they wanted to wait until the Friedrichs decision was done. And that was essentially postponed until this decision today. And so they'll be organizing to wipe away those pensions. They'll be organizing to wipe away rights of every kind. And that's, you know, you can see that not only the court decisions regarding the travel ban, regarding the limitation on employees being able to join together collectively to bring legal claims on work-related issues, on women's rights to information about abortion, on gay people's right to get cake from a cake shop, on voter purges, on racist gerrymandering, all that type of stuff. It's seen in Trump's attempt to privatize, his stated attempt last week to privatize the Postal Service and the Tennessee Valley Authority and Freddie Mac and all these other things. His executive orders attacking the bargaining rights of the public sector unions and the federal sector with AFSCME. This is a very broad attack right now, very serious attack, and the battle lines are being drawn. It may not be in the headlines and to the extent that some of the other elements of this anti-working class assault is, for example, immigration, but it's very definitely coming after labor rights at every level. So the struggle is on.
Yeah, Peter Nolan, it's a frontal assault against labor. I mean, there's all kinds of sort of nuanced, or they're not really nuanced, but slightly hidden assaults on labor. This is like the government of the United States, which, you know, at least since 1935 has attempted to appear, at least in some instances, as a mediating force. But this is the government itself becoming, as Jeff said, a dagger at the sort of juggler for labor. We've had this phenomena where in right to work states, and that's what we're talking about, Janice making all states right to work states in essence for public sector workers. We've seen the teachers on the march, though, the teachers on the move, in spite of the limitations of dues collection and the fact that they're open shops. We have this new sort of, who would have thought, perhaps the vanguard of a revived labor movement coming from, quote, red states by unions that don't have these kind of advantages. Go ahead. We have about 3 minutes left.
I'll be very quickly. I mean, I'm not at all surprised, and we're not at all surprised because we represent a lot of workers in right-to-work states. So we're not at all surprised that at some point workers can only take so much, and then they take whatever action is necessary for them to be heard, and more importantly, to actually deliver the goods. And clearly, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, and Tennessee workers figured that out and were able to, you know, make some real economic substantial advances for their members and for others in their states in very substantial ways. And I think regardless of whether you have right to work or you don't, the disintegration of living standards for American workers and our families in the United States over the last 30, 40, 50 years seems to get more precipitous and worse as each year goes by, especially when it comes to the payroll deductions that we continually have increased on our paychecks for health insurance. And that issue is just the economic squeeze is on. So this just sort of doubles down on the part of the right wing and corporate America. Janus is just one more piling on of its attempt to destroy the labor movement, which it will not do. Frankly, I mean, when workers get pissed off, they get emotional and they pull together and they develop organization. Then they know inherently that we have more numbers. And that is where our focus has to be, is on our numbers and utilizing the strength of our membership and the numbers of unorganized and organized workers in order to get what we need. And that has not been lost on people. This is going to be a blow, no doubt about it. Janus is definitely going to be a blow to organize labor, but we will keep moving forward as best we can in the ways that we know how.
30 seconds left. And Jeff, what the teachers also showed is the power of the strike. I mean, labor has been doing a lot of building coalitions with different community groups and youth groups, but here we saw again the power of the strike. 30 seconds left.
Yes, essentially, it's an essential tactic that has been sometimes ignored or avoided too much because it brings into focus all the contradictions of society. It shows who's on what side. And so the teachers in these struggles that have just been mentioned have been at the spearhead of that, a spearhead of the labor movement for greater rights, for greater power on the job. But also, as you pointed out, it's not just the teachers as the spearhead, but their success has been in relationship to their community ties, that they have grassroots, profound community support, and that's what's helped propel them to a position of success and winning. And that will be the key, that type of struggle and that type of community support will be the key to our future.
All right, we're going to leave it there. That was the voice of Jeff Bigelow. Jeff is an official with AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We're also joined by Peter Knowlton from Massachusetts. Peter is the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we continue our regular segment every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We do this with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can see his writings and the work of the organization at beyondnuclear.org. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole, Kevin Camps, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks.
Kevin, as we do every week prior to the show, you highlight some of the big stories of the week. And there are so many. And sadly, in spite of the fact that nuclear energy and nuclear waste and nuclear weapons have such a profound impact now on society and potentially an even profounder impact should things go wrong, and things do go wrong. We don't get many of these issues covered in the mainstream media, so we're very, very pleased to be able to have your expertise every week on this segment. But just help us start. What's the big story? Where do you want to begin?
Well, certainly the North Korea situation is in the news continuously, and an organization called 38 North has regular updates. It has access to commercial satellite imagery, and so they take a peek from time to time at the Yongbyon nuclear power plant facility in North Korea. And one of the points they're making is that the nuclear facilities there are still operational. In fact, there are new buildings being constructed. They look like office-type buildings, perhaps to welcome dignitaries of the North Korean government who want to visit the site. So it's not clear that, you know, the works are being expanded in significant ways, military capacity-wise. But what's really interesting and comes to my mind is, you know, North Korea is under this microscope. And at the same time, something ironic is happening in the United States. So there's so much concern about plutonium production and reprocessing to separate it out of the high-level radioactive waste in North Korea, where it can and is being used for nuclear weaponry. While at the same time, just this week, a few days ago, both Republican senators from Idaho, joined by Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island, a Democrat, were able to orchestrate some funding out in Idaho to extract plutonium from U.S. Nuclear Navy high-level radioactive waste to use as fuel in so-called advanced atomic reactors on the commercial side in this country. And what's really bad about that is that it's sending a green light internationally that, well, if the United States can do this for supposedly commercial civilian atoms for peace reasons, actually it's just a huge favor to the Idaho National Laboratory and companies that are on the gravy train from the U.S. Treasury to do this kind of work, then why can't North Korea do it? I mean, there's going to come a point, and there has in the past, like in the 1990s, where the exchange between the U.S. and North Korea, the agreed framework was, if you give up atoms for war, we will give you atoms for peace. And they were building two commercial atomic reactors in North Korea. That project got scuttled when the agreement fell apart. And, you know, it's just the hypocrisy, the double dealing that goes on.
Indeed. I'm not even sure those two light water reactors that were promised North Korea, along with heavy oil crude oil shipments from overseas, I'm not sure those were even started, were they?
I'm not sure how far it got. One of the most ironic parts of it all for me was, you know, that began under the Clinton administration, continued for a very short time under the Bush. And one of the board members of ABB, the Swiss nuclear company that was involved, was none other than Donald Rumsfeld. So there's that too.
Yeah, I was in North Korea in 2000 and 2001, and I remember that a big complaint of the North Koreans, something they brought up a lot, was the U.S. hadn't lived up to its side of the 1994 General Framework Agreement. And just so for our audience to realize what happened there, there was almost a war at that time between the U.S. and North Korea. And Jimmy Carter went and met with Kim Il-sung. You know, we hear a lot, Donald Trump has never met with a North Korean. No president has ever met with a North Korean head of state. Well, Jimmy Carter, former president, did meet with Kim Il-sung following, of course, he was no longer president, but he was a president, and they came to this agreement whereby the DPRK would suspend its nuclear weapons program or not begin it in earnest, because I don't think it was very far along. And in exchange, and this was right after the Soviet Union had fallen, so North Korea needed energy sources. They had lost most of their energy supplies from the Soviet Union and their allies in Eastern Europe, those governments that also fell. So that was the quid pro quo. And the North Koreans were always saying, you're just really still trying to overthrow us because you haven't started building these light water reactors. Anyway, I want to go, though, Kevin, I want to stay in this before we come back to the Idaho story. The Guardian newspaper has the headline, North Korea making, quote, rapid, close quote, upgrades to nuclear reactor despite summit pledges. I'm not sure this, even if this upgrade is, as you're discussing, I'm not sure it's a violation of the summit pledges, no matter what, even on its face, because the summit agreement was, number one, the U.S. and the DPRK would have a new, better, normal relation. Number two, that there would be an ongoing peace mechanism to avert another Korean War. And three, a long-range commitment to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which means on both sides.
Well, that denuclearization part, you know, as Walter has pointed out on past shows, does not apply to the United States. That's what's so incredible. And that that hypocrisy goes all the way back to the beginning of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which North Korea was a party to until 2003, when it was declared a part of the Axis of Evil. And it saw what happened to Iraq, another member of this Axis of Evil. It saw what happened to Libya, and it decided to build nuclear weapons to defend itself. So that's another double standard, and the United States has little to no interest in disarming of its nuclear weapons, and that's becoming more and more of an unacceptable situation internationally. So there's this new United Nations treaty, and the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize last year for its role in the hammering out of this treaty, which, as time goes on, more and more countries are ratifying the treaty. And so the United States and other nuclear weapons powers are going to be rogues internationally, and it's about time.
I just want to add, even in that same article that you're talking about, Brian, the article cites 38 North, which is the monitoring group that took these images and analyzed these images. And you know, they list out some of what those experts talked about. And I just want to quote from that. So this is in that exact same article with the headline, North Korea making rapid upgrades to nuclear reactor despite summit pledges. And they say, continued work at the facility should not be seen as having any relationship to North Korea's pledge to denuclearize. So as always, you know, this headline is completely divorced from the actual content and not at all what the experts are saying.
Yeah, and 38 North isn't really a monitoring group. They just access the satellite imagery. I think they're a think tank, more or less, correct?
Well, they do have expertise in identifying what the imagery means. And they, in this same article, in the same blog post on their website, they point out that they can't tell what's happening at the reprocessing facility. They can't tell if there's smoke coming out of the stack. And, you know, that's why I brought up reprocessing in Idaho, because we're doing it too.
Yeah. So again, let's go to Idaho. Is it legal?
Well, you know, it's been a funny tit for tat over decades. Ford, when he was running against Carter back in the mid 1970s, banned the export of reprocessing from the United States in direct response to what India had done the year before with its test blast called Smiling Buddha, which the Indians, using our rhetoric, called a peaceful nuclear explosion, as if they were developing a way to build big ditches or something. And we had been making the same arguments here. Why can't we explode hydrogen bombs in Alaska to build a new harbor? That kind of thing. They didn't get away with it in Alaska. But so Ford was trying to outflank Carter on a vulnerable issue. And then when Carter won the presidency, came in, he essentially banned reprocessing in the United States, which was a really good thing, because we had made a huge mess in West Valley, New York. There have been huge messes made in Hanford, Washington, in Idaho, in South Carolina from reprocessing, mostly for weapons purposes, but a little bit for commercial purposes in New York. And then Reagan came in, he undid the ban. And then Clinton came in, reapplied the ban.
And for technical understanding, the ban was an executive order?
I believe so.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
And so it's gone back and forth. Unfortunately, reprocessing in the United States has always maintained some life support in terms of funding from Congress at a level of $100 million per year, $150 million per year, U.S. taxpayer dollars going to these national nuclear labs like Idaho National Laboratory to keep doing what they call research. And so in this particular case, this funding that just got approved on the Senate side, it's not been approved on the House side yet, would fund reprocessing of nuclear Navy irradiated nuclear fuel in Idaho, extract the plutonium for reuse in so-called advanced atomic reactors. And one of the lead designs these days is called small modular reactors. And I think that Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democrat from Rhode Island, is very close to a company called Holtec International. And unfortunately, so is Cory Booker, because this company is based in New Jersey. And these senators put out an op-ed many months ago where they said small modular reactors, especially these by Holtec, are really the way to go. And that is going to be another nuclear gravy train paid for by U.S. taxpayers if this happens. And Holtec is the same company that's trying to build that dump out in New Mexico. And so they won't admit any of this, but they held a press conference April of 2017 on the Hill where they were touting reprocessing. If they could just get the waste to New Mexico, they could reprocess it. They could extract the plutonium. And guess what? They have a small atomic reactor division. And maybe that plutonium could fuel their small atomic reactors, as they call them, all of it paid for by U.S. taxpayers. And again, when you're reprocessing, when you're extracting plutonium from high-level radioactive waste, if you choose to, you can use it for bombs. And so the U.S. is sending this message that commercial reprocessing is okay. So why can't other countries do it?
Well, they're calling it recycling, so it's green, right?
They have focus grouped that, and they call
it
that. And one way of looking at it is recycling death, because reprocessing, one of the aspects that doesn't get covered very much is the environmental devastation that it wreaks, even if there's not an accident. So in West Valley, New York, they only did 6 years of reprocessing, and they only accomplished 1 year's worth of throughput. They had fires, they had accidents, they had leaks, they had worker overexposures. This was back in the 60s, early 70s. And the cleanup bill that has not taken place yet would be $10 billion just for 6 years of reprocessing activities. And if they don't do that $10 billion cleanup, it is going to flow into Lake Erie and it's going to flow into Lake Ontario. It may take centuries, but it is eroding into the lakes as we speak.
Okay, so having grown up on Lake Ontario... And Lake Erie had been a dead lake. It's back to life now. But this would really make everything dead, right? I mean, what's the alternative?
We have to stop making high-level radioactive waste in the first place. But for what exists, reprocessing it is the worst thing you can do with high-level radioactive waste that exists. All we can do is isolate it from the environment forevermore. And that's going to be a huge challenge. And that's why these ideas like the New Mexico Centralized Interim Storage Facility of Holtec, a Texas equivalent, 40 miles away, just across the state line. That's waste control specialists. Yucca Mountain, Nevada, which is Western Shoshone Indian land where they want to bury this stuff, are all such bad ideas because the waste will not be isolated from the environment in these places. So what the environmental movement has long called for in this country is hardened on-site storage as close as possible to the point of generation to buy ourselves time. Because the current storage technologies, wet pool storage, those are catastrophes waiting to happen if the cooling water is lost, almost happened at Fukushima Daiichi. And instead of 160,000 nuclear evacuees, as we saw in 2011, it could have been up to 35 million to 50 million people. So
that's
orders
like,
of magnitude.
That's like half
worse.
Of Japan.
And the prime minister serving at the time who admitted all this a year later after he was out of office, Naoto Kan, said it would have been the end of the Japanese state to get all of Metro Tokyo and all of northeastern Japan out of harm's way if that pool had caught on fire. Our pool risks are greater than that. We have packed more waste into our pools in this country than Japan had at Fukushima Daiichi. So there's that. And even our dry cast storage, our overflow storage for high-level radioactive waste out in the parking lot, that is vulnerable to accidents, to attacks, to natural disasters. So that's why we're calling for hardened on-site storage.
So stop producing any more waste. In other words, stop producing, stop, move away completely, immediately, urgently from nuclear power. Stop producing more. And then take this waste and put it in case-hardened facilities.
Not right on water, not right in the middle of very important environmental areas.
See,
in this country.
That's the dilemma when you start looking at where the atomic reactors are on the shores of the Great Lakes, on the seacoasts of this country, on the rivers, all built in these places for cooling water purposes. Now you've got forever deadly high-level radioactive waste parked on these surface waters. And that's a dilemma because seas are rising. There's all kinds of things that can happen on the Great Lakes, even tsunamis. There have been recent reports of tsunami generation in various ways on the Great Lakes. If they hit that storage, that can be bad. I mean, the Great Lakes are drinking water for tens of millions of people in the U.S. and Canada and Native American First Nations. So we have to worry about all of that. It's a huge dilemma because none of the proposals for where to send it elsewhere are good.
I'm waiting for somebody to propose sending it to outer space. On a rocket.
There have been madcap proposals like that, but the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion on takeoff would be one cautionary tale. And We've had satellites that have nuclear material on board crash back.
By the way, was there on the Challenger explosion? I was reading materials back then, 32 years ago, I think by Carl Grossman, about it. Was there a piece of radioactive equipment on the Challenger? Or no, it was supposed to be on the next Challenger.
The next mission. And Carl Grossman's on our board of directors. So one of his areas of specialty for all these decades has been nukes in space. And he's also on the board of the Global Network Against Nuclear Weapons and Power in Space. And yes, the next mission was going to be a significant plutonium payload. And another big one that Carl wrote a book on was the Cassini probe that went out to, the deep reaches of our solar system that was powered by plutonium-238. And the design of the mission was not only liftoff, but also a slingshot maneuver past Venus and past the Earth. If that thing had exploded on liftoff or crashed back into the Earth's atmosphere, the NASA safety officer in the environmental impact statement reported that 5 billion human beings would have been exposed to hazardous plutonium in the atmosphere. They would have breathed it in.
So let's just go back again. This was 1986. The Challenger blew up. And Carl Grossman, I'm now remembering his articles. Back then, he made the point that the next mission was going to include this plutonium reactor, or a reactor that produced plutonium. I don't know what the right word.
It was an energy source, I believe. I don't know the details.
It was an energy source. It was going to power a long-distance mission. And that if it had blown up at the point that the Challenger blew up, there was enough plutonium, would have been enough plutonium. And if dispersed, like Florida, the population of Florida, which is where the explosion happened, would have been basically wiped out very quickly.
And all of that came into really dark light when Cassini was launched and all of these warnings were being issued. The NASA safety officer actually resigned his position because of the risks involved, and they did it anyway. So we survived the liftoff of Cassini, but then there was the slingshot maneuver past the Earth. And just to give folks an idea, NASA missed Mars with a lander because they had forgotten to convert from metric to English or the other direction. They missed the planet. It didn't land. It sailed off into the nether regions. If that had happened with Cassini, for any reason, if it had crashed back into the Earth, the same effect, only higher and worse, because it would have vaporized the entire Cassini space probe, including the plutonium, and dispersed it evenly around the world. And just a speck of plutonium in your lung will initiate lung cancer.
Yeah, just a speck. Well, like a speck is a speck. We're talking about something that's not even visible. I mean, not even, it's an infinitesimal amount of plutonium.
The thread that always gets me the longer we do this segment is just that the risks are not super likely, but they are so, so, so high. And we're always depending on humans humans make errors, and that's okay, unless we're talking about the risks that come with this kind of really intense, like, nuclear work. And it's just not worth the risk. It's just not worth it. And
have you been won over to the idea that we should get rid of nuclear energy?
I think so.
when we started this segment, tell the truth, were you convinced of it at that time, or were you just learning about it?
I was still learning about it. And I was still learning about it. I was still unsure about, the climate change is moving, and it's moving quickly. And there's a well-funded debate going on with, whether nuclear is kind of the answer for
fossil fuels,
for clean energy. Yeah. And obviously renewables, I think many, not everyone, but many agree that renewables are obviously just the way to go. But based on the current funding levels and based on, as always, these political decisions that we have to make, I wasn't sure. But yeah, I'm
so
convinced.
Kevin, if Nicole is a focus group, a sample group, if people
yes,
are...
Yes, I am representative of the U.S. in so many ways.
I think you represent most people in the United States,
for sure.
But that's the thing, is if people listen to you every week, as Nicole is and I am and Walter and John Kiriakou and our audience, if people listen to you every week, you can't really come to another conclusion.
You can't.
I mean, what we could do, perhaps, is maybe we could set up a debate, Kevin, with you and some advocate who will take the other position so that you can crush them. But not literally. But, But I think it does, when you hear the facts, when we hear and discuss what's actually going on and the history, like we miss Mars because we failed to convert.
Because it sounds crazy that that something would just crash back into the Earth. That's not going to happen. NASA knows what they're doing, except that these things do happen, right? They do happen.
And Carl, in his writing over the decades, has documented instances where there have been satellites that have crashed back to Earth that were bearing nuclear materials. The Soviet Union had some of those happen. The U.S. had that happen with Apollo 13, the infamous screwed up mission where the astronauts survived, but the plutonium they had on board went down to the ocean bottom, which, you know, the nuclear establishment's going to say it's a big ocean. They're saying that about Fukushima Daiichi. Oh, it's a big ocean. Don't worry about it. It'll dilute. And we say that's delusion. You know, plutonium is ultra hazardous. We shouldn't be dumping it in the ocean by accident or intentionally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, we're already dumping so many other things in the ocean. Like, let's just limit, right? Like anything. And plutonium is obviously way more dangerous.
That's another cautionary tale for reprocessing is the French reprocessing facility at La Hague on their northwest coast is a major contributor of radioactivity, artificial radioactive poison to the ocean. And the British equivalent, Sellafield, into the Irish Sea. And so if they were to do reprocessing in New Mexico at Holtec, we're talking about massive airborne emissions of hazardous radioactivity on a normal day, and also hazardous surface water contamination. Not that there's surface water out there, but they're going to have to deal with this wastewater that is highly radioactive. So it's an environmental devastation wherever reprocessing takes place.
Speaking of clean energy and renewables, you also mentioned that the kind of mini spending package that was passed this week was supposed to have some clean energy programming in it. Can you tell us kind of what else was in that bill and what else came out of that?
Well, environmental groups in coalition and by the scores of groups across the country weighed in with both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, urging that, you know, centralized interim storage in the Senate bill not be funded. But they agreed to fund it anyway, and also urging the House to not pursue Yucca Mountain funding, but they did it anyway. And so what's interesting is there's this impasse between the two houses of Congress. The Senate wants centralized interim storage. The House wants Yucca Mountain. That's kind of it in a nutshell. And the environmental movement is saying, these are all bad ideas. Don't do this. We've been calling for hardened on-site storage. There's no talk of that on the Hill. So it goes on. There's going to be a conference committee now between House and Senate, and we'll see what comes out of conference committee. You know, the good news is the state of Nevada, like it has for a generation, is fighting Yucca tooth and nail. Democrats in New Mexico, it's probably going to become a major issue in the governor's race in New Mexico because the Democrat, Michelle Lujan Grisham, voted against these ideas and doesn't think centralized interim storage in New Mexico is a good idea because it may get stuck there forever. Whereas the Republican candidate, Steve Pierce, is the current congressman from Southeast New Mexico. He thinks Holtec is a great idea. So it could well become a major governor's race issue out there. In, you know, as my colleague Leona Morgan with Nuclear Issues Study Group points out, New Mexico is where nuclear colonialism began in this country with Los Alamos. And it continues to this day. Los Alamos, Sandia, major nuclear laboratories based in New Mexico, one of the biggest employers, huge political power. And despite that, there's tremendous resistance in New Mexico at the grassroots to these dumps.
I have to assume that people of New Mexico are absolutely not on board. And I mean, having these kind of waste facilities is incredibly dangerous and not something that the people would want either.
Yeah, we've dominated. The opposition has dominated the microphone at the public meetings, which have been few in number and only in New Mexico. And the other big issue is the transportation risks to get the waste out west. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has adamantly refused dead silence from the NRC to hold these public comment meetings elsewhere in the country. And even the Department of Energy, which is no tree hugger, did a better job at this stage of things with the Yucca Mountain dump in terms of going to about 20 places around the country that would see major numbers of shipments come through out to the Yucca Mountain dump. This was back in the mid-90s. The NRC, for a bigger proposal, a much bigger proposal, this centralized interim storage facility in New Mexico, has not held a single public comment meeting outside of New Mexico.
Well, I just happened to have talked to like a political activist who's from Albuquerque yesterday, and she said a lot of people are talking about this. It's a big issue, and normally nuclear issues are not a big issue in activist circles. It's, you know, maybe Black Lives Matter or the issues of war and peace, Syria, whatever. But she said it's a big issue right now and that there's a lot of people doing things about it. And there was awareness and consciousness about it. We're talking with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and join it, get involved in Beyond Nuclear, support it by going to beyondnuclear.org.
Kevin, you said there was also an update on the Davis-Besse plant. Do you want to tell us what's going on?
Well, the NRC has annual performance review meetings, and the Cleveland Plain Dealer had an article that said, where were the people? Nobody showed up for this meeting. Nobody had any questions about, you know, is the plant going to operate past 2020 or not? What's going to happen with the decommissioning, the dismantlement of facilities, and the cleanup of the radioactive contamination? First of all, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a captured agency. It's a kangaroo court. These are dog and pony shows. We've been to countless of these meetings. No wonder the public doesn't show up. They're disgusted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, let alone the company. And the NRC official who was quoted in the article, James Cameron, really stepped over the line on this one because he was asked by a reporter, what would happen to the community if the plant shuts down? He said, oh, it'd be devastating. That's not the NRC's job to keep old plants operating. They're supposed to only enforce safety regulations. Whether the plant operates or not is not their mandate. So they're just out of control. What would really be devastating for that region is if Davis-Besse melts down and its severely cracked containment is guaranteed to fail in a meltdown, and that region of the country would be taken out.
1 minute left, Kevin Camps. I wanted to ask you a question. I was kind of intrigued by it. What's the difference between the new treaty that you talked about, the nuclear weapons treaty, compared to the nuclear nonproliferation treaty from 1969? 1 minute left.
Essentially, the new treaty, the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, makes it illegal to have them, to seek them, to possess them, to transfer them. It just makes illegal nuclear weapons and calls for their abolition entirely. And one major difference is the nuclear weapons powers that be, many of them, have no intention of disarming or dismantling their nuclear arsenals. And that's, you know, 50 years into the nonproliferation treaty where they were supposed to, in good faith, enter negotiations to talk about the abolition of their nuclear weapons. They've never gotten around to that in 50 years. So this new treaty would require it by international law.
Wow, 1969. Next year is the 50th anniversary. Again, an important treaty, but one that is, in essence, not doing what it promised. And what it's legally required to do. And again, for people in the United States signed that treaty. And by signing that treaty after a ratification by more than a two-thirds majority in the Senate, it is the law of the land. And according to the U.S. Constitution, the highest law of the land, a treaty. And as a consequence, the U.S. government, and I would say not just the executive, but all the members of Congress are complicit in this international law breaking. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined in studio by Kevin Camps. He joins us every Wednesday in our segment called Beyond Nuclear. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org. And we've been joined also in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.